Welcome to Sex, Body and Soul. I'm Kate Roberts, founder of The Body Agency, and on this show, we talk about the marvel that is our bodies, what they can do, and what they need to thrive. Ladies out there, our time is now. Let's get to it. Our next guest, Joanna Bischel, is the founder and CEO of Kasha, which is an e-commerce platform for women's health and self-care and a leading femtech organization across Africa. Joanna was born in Poland and raised in Canada, and she has a bachelor's degree in computer science, and she's worked in technology solutions all over the world. In her early career, she actually worked for Microsoft, and then also for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working across East and West Africa. Welcome to the show. Joanna, my friend, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
It's so good to see you again. It feels like yesterday, although it was a few months ago in where we saw each other in Rwanda. It was just such a privilege to come down and watch you in action and see your operation, which I've been hearing for years and years about. And actually, no, you are somewhat of a legend, Joanna. I love it when I can bring female leaders really making a difference in the world onto the show and talk about you, what you do, how you do it. And you are absolutely one of those heroes and or heroines in my mind. So, Joanna, how does a girl born in Poland, being brought up in Canada, end up in Rwanda doing last mile healthcare?
And now living in Kenya.
Not usual, right?
Yes.
This is not normal.
Yeah, well, it's the journey of life in a sense. Yeah, and my entrepreneurship was life. It really did extend from journey and personal growth and just experiences. And so, yeah, I was born in Poland, but we immigrated to Canada when I was really young. So I grew up in Canada. I have a computer science degree, and Microsoft hired me out of school. So that brought me to the US. So actually, I started out in tech. So I was a software developer at Microsoft. I also ran businesses, international teams, had a great career. But I've always been interested in tech and emerging markets. So I was doing things like pro bono work, volunteering, getting involved in especially tech startups in emerging markets. And motherhood has always had such an impact on me. Mm. So when my son was born, I realized I don't want my VP's job. I'm not interested in doing that job. I love working in emerging markets and working on tech solutions. And so, you know, when you have a child, you think, am I spending my time well? And I realized I wanted to move into the space. And so at that time, also an opportunity with Gates Foundation opened up. So that's when I officially moved my career into the kind of global development space, global health space. And then I spent, yeah, about 3-4 years at Gates Foundation working on tech across East and West Africa and South Asia on things like agriculture and health services delivery and financial services for low-income individuals, various different things. And then I had my second child. And again, I questioned, is this really the right place to be? And there are a lot of learnings, frustrations, things that led to starting Kasha in the end. And I had done quite a lot of work across East Africa, and the idea for Kasha was building at that time. And so I decided to start the company, decided to start in Rwanda. And yeah, the rest is history. And I couldn't think of a name. And my daughter was just born. Her name's Kasha. So I used the name Kasha.
Oh, what a legacy. Wow. Well, I didn't know that actually.
Oh,
but what a legacy. So, as you know, I've also been working in healthcare and developing markets for the last, gosh, almost 25 years. Oh, it's aging me. And hands down, I believe that the private sector is the solution for access to healthcare, period. And also in a combination approach of, you know, combination of philanthropic dollars, but also private sector techniques, private sector distribution. And you have absolutely nailed it with what you're doing with Kasha. And do you want to just tell us exactly what Kasha does in a way for our listeners to understand what the company's mission is? Like, when you started Kasha, what was your end game? Like, what was your vision?
Yeah, maybe I can go back and also tell you what led to starting Kesha. And that really goes into our mission and why we do what we do and why we operate how we do. So my background is mostly within private sector. My career has been mostly in private sector, but I did spend, you know, several years working in the donor world, in the philanthropic space, in global health. And it was quite shocking to see how that world operates. And just to give you some examples, you know, what I love about business is you're really serving a customer and you're providing value to a customer. And if a customer does not see it as value, they don't come back, you know? And especially if you're dealing with low income individuals, so their money is so precious to them. If they buy your product again and again, that's very high value. And so the metrics within business make a lot of sense to me. Whereas the metrics in the kind of global development space are leading metrics rather than lagging metrics. It's really not getting at the heart of the issue. So I've seen donors change strategies and NGOs completely change their strategies because they couldn't get the money anymore. And so there's a lot of issues around that for sure.
You know, one thing that I've seen over the years is even if you are at the bottom of the social economic pyramid, right, you are going to value something that you purchase and you're going to use it over and over again versus if somebody just gives you something for free. Mentally, you just don't value that, right?
Absolutely. We've seen people, I mean, very, very low income people, but they're willing to pay a little bit more because it feels like quality and it's not a donation and it's not something for the poor. And it makes them feel, there's a lot of like psychology around money and buying things for sure at all socioeconomic levels. But the interesting thing, if we also just bring it into the lives of women and girls within emerging markets, it was, you know, global health operates in this very top-down way. And, you know, I used to be part of these supply chain planning groups where, you know, it was shocking to see how billions of people get the health products they need. So, for example, if you look at family planning, contraceptives, there's really only two entities globally that make the decisions within family planning space, which products go around the world. So UNFPA and USAID decide which products and how many units of those products go to each country. And the data they have to work with is, you know, very poor data. You know, they have some five-year-old health survey data. Some countries refuse to give data on unmarried women related to contraceptives. So you don't see any data on unmarried. So you miss a huge part of the population. And basically, a few people in a room make a choice that, you know, we should send this many units of Depo-Provera to Ethiopia. And then it gets sent, you know, and it's really, and there's no question as to, or there's no ability to really see what is the preference of women within that area. How does that differ by region? What is their unique circumstance? What would they choose? And so somebody in a developed market picks a number. Those products land at the port and then nobody has any idea where it goes. And there's no visibility. There's, you know, and there could be corruption in the country. There could be lack of proper storage. And it's really no wonder these products are not getting to people, you know, who need them most. And so coming from a private sector perspective, you know, that's absolutely shocking. And when you look at technology and private sector has really been able to adopt technology. And so then to see that global health, this is how it operates, is insane because it's the same world. And even in these same countries, if you look at, you know, private sector industries, the mobile payment space, various things, there's, you know, there's incredible amount of data, not as much as developed markets, but there is enough to turn supply chains upside down and make them consumer driven so that women choose what they want, women, and, you know, it gets to where they need it to come to. So I think that was also shock is just the lack of the use of data and tech. Tech is often used in global development to digitize very broken systems, which you just get more broken, you know, garbage in, garbage out.
And also seeing the inadequacies of the medical healthcare system, right? So what we're seeing here is medications and healthcare services being offered en masse online. Like you literally can get your healthcare now pretty much without leaving the house. And that is essentially what you have done with Kesha, right? You've developed this incredible entrepreneurial system that I would love for you to talk about very clearly of how that works for your end user, your customer. How do they get access?
Yeah, with Kesha, we're really aiming to disrupt the global health industry. We really want to turn those global health supply chains upside down and make them customer-driven and data-driven, reaching the last mile, optimized for women. And that's how Kesha was built. And we're basically like an, you know, a digital retail and wholesale platform, like an e-commerce platform, but really, really built for this part of the world. So most people order using a basic phone, you know, over a short code, no smartphone or internet access required, yet they can confidentially order that. And then we deliver to the last mile around the country. And so we've basically enabled this way to confidentially get the products you need, choose the ones you want. And in that way, every time you place an order, this is a vote. This is actually that data point. And when you order that product again, and it's and you have full range of choice, you order this product, that is your preference. And that's how we aim to turn global health supply chains upside down, because all of a sudden we see this map of this is actually what people prefer. This is what women prefer. This is what, you know, families prefer for their health and their household. And so Kesha is a digital retail last mile distribution platform for health and household goods. And we also have an enterprise part of our business where we work with pharma manufacturers that use Kesha as a channel to actually reach new markets, access populations that they've never had data to before. And a key difference we've made as opposed to maybe other companies is we're not just health. We optimize for women's health, but we don't just do women and we don't just do health. We do health and household goods. And for us, we recognize that really enables the customer, which is usually the woman, to order confidentially. She could be ordering anything. If she orders an emergency contraceptive, people may think she's ordering soap or she's ordering toilet paper or rice or something for. And so being able to provide a basket of products, but still enabling easy access to those stigmatized products is really key. So that's how we've built Kesha in that way.
No, it's fascinating. And I've seen it in action. And it's remarkable what you've done, Joanna. Congratulations. Now, the businesswoman in me also is interested in the way that you have also been funded. Because I have so many thoughts on this, right? You've got, and again, to our listeners, you've got NGOs out there who are completely funded by, you know, organizations like USAID and foundations like the Gates Foundation. They're basically given money to do what you're doing, but it's in a on a nonprofit basis. Now, Kesha, from my understanding, you have a bunch of investors, right, who are ultimately interested in getting a return on their investment, right? And then you have corporate partners where you source the products from. You don't manufacture anything yourself, right? You source everything. And through your investments that you've had from the private sector, from individuals and organizations, you have enough money to operate. And then you source these products in a way that makes it affordable for your customer to be able to buy them. Household goods and healthcare, medical supplies, and so on. Do you also have medical devices?
We're going deeper into medical devices, but right now it's more around the rapid diagnostics and those types of medical devices, as well as breast pumps. And so that's more of the smaller, kind of easy to deliver devices is what we do.
Now, I would imagine, again, my knowledge of, you know, these big companies like P&G and Unilever and you know, a lot of pharmas are very interested in your model, because essentially what you have is a vast distribution network reaching people at the bottom and the middle of the social economic pyramid. So are you bombarded with companies wanting to get their product out to this sector?
Yeah, actually, that's why our enterprise business is so thriving, because it's shocking, actually, how little of Africa as a continent a lot of these global enterprises reach. You know, maybe they're in the tier one markets, but, you know, majority of the population, they don't know what sells. they don't know where to send it to. And so, you know, there's a huge population, especially, you know, 90% of retail takes place in this low income, informal customer segment. And if you can consolidate that market, it's an extremely large, powerful market. And if you're optimized around women, and for us, this is how we run our business. We recognize women as the most influential customer. If you look at something like menstrual care, women purchase menstrual care every month for over 40 years, one woman. And, you know, extrapolate that to hundreds of millions of women. I mean, it's such an underserved market, and most of them can't get the products they need. And so we need to change the way we operate, the way that things work in developed markets. It's not necessarily how they work in emerging markets. So we need to leverage tech more. We need more distributed, less brick and mortar. And so that's why these type of channels are very important.
Well, one thing I'm particularly excited about, and you and I have been having these conversations, is the fact that most of the world focuses on the girl in her reproductive years. So we start off with, you know, maternal health and making sure a woman gives birth in a safe and healthy way. Then it's like, okay, she's then going to get a period. So we give her menstrual hygiene products, right? Then we give her contraception, and then it stops because we go into menopause. And, you know, we're struggling here in the US to find doctors and health products to help women through menopause. But you step out of the US and Western markets, and there's not even a conversation about menopause. So I'm actually excited that we're having these conversations of how, you know, Kasia and the Body Agency can really team up to make sure that the girl and the woman gets the health care that she needs throughout her entire life, and not just when she is able to produce babies. So I guess my question to you is, well, what happens? You know, what's the word there in Rwanda about that time of your life? And, you know, where has your interest come in this area? Is it through demand?
Within just all the stages of a woman's life cycle, you mean? Or
yeah, as in, to put context, you know, I've worked in global health for the last 25 years, focused mainly on, you know, markets like yours in Africa, India, and so on, developing countries. Not once in those 25 years of raising money and looking at social enterprises and delivering healthcare have I even heard the word menopause uttered, not from a donor, not from, you know, the private sector. It's just non-existent. And so I'm interested to hear from you. Well, what happens to a woman in Rwanda when she goes through menopause? Is there a direct dial to get the health products and services that she needs? Because it is a massive, massive untapped market.
Yeah. And I would say actually in so many areas across a woman's life cycle, it's similar. There's so little information that it's almost like each woman has to experience it and go through the shock of figuring out what to do herself. I mean, one of the reasons Kasia started was in global health, the only thing that I ever worked on related to women was women's pregnancy, so maternal health, and family planning. That's it. And there's no talk of menstruation. There's absolutely no talk of menopause. There was no talk of anything else. It was not a topic. In fact, when I tried to figure out where's the menstruation part, it's under the Ministry of Education. That's, you know, it's a separate, that's not health. Okay. So it's really just around the baby making. And so, you know, what we've learned just from our years of working in Rwanda and Kenya and other countries within Africa as well, is there's really so little information around all this. So often when a girl gets her period for the first time, she thinks she's dying because she's bleeding. She has no idea what's happening because it's not talked about. And then, you know, there's so many stigmas around things like contraceptives as well. And then menopause is also not something that's talked about. So that's, you know, people push through that as well. There's also what we see is there's an absolute pandemic, really, or epidemic around diabetes and hypertension. So even around that, and there's incredible demand, but many people haven't even been screened. So I think in general, in the emerging market-based developing countries, the narrative is really driven by donors. And donors have a lot of focus on things like HIV/AIDS, maternal health, family planning. And that's pretty much it. Or it's, you know, those are the big ones. And everything else, you're on your own in a way. And governments, you know, definitely put a lot of work into this, but massively underfunded, very manual, and also built, you know, a young woman today does not necessarily want to read a medical pamphlet. So really just adjusting to the world of today and making sure that the content that people get is actually relevant to them and consumable and, you know, trusted. So a lot of our business as well is around just driving awareness and education on these are all the things available to you at many stages of your life. And here's the information. So and here's a mobile clinic where you actually can get tested or screened. So that's a big part of also just driving awareness, which of course people realize that they actually, maybe they need some health products and things like that. But education is a key part, especially in low-income and rural communities.
Now, I've been coming to Africa for a really, really long time, different parts of Africa. And I've always seen Rwanda. And every single time I've come, met with the government, seen the amazing work that the government has done, quite frankly, in a very progressive way, especially around issues like HIV/AIDS, right? And no one is arguing that, you know, especially in healthcare, the Rwandan government is probably leagues ahead of other countries in this regard. And as you know, I was recently in Rwanda this year together with Deborah Messing, who's on our board. And we have together, you know, traveled to many countries looking at the healthcare system. And as you say, sort of to get educated on last mile health and what is necessary. And in a way, I was a little taken aback by this last trip because I was expecting, quite frankly, not as much poverty as I saw. And, you know, we went out to rural areas as well as looking at the urban situation. And, you know, in my mind, not much has changed. As in the conversations that we had, and granted, they were at the absolute bottom of the social economic pyramid where, you know, people were really struggling. Families did not have access to the healthcare that they need. And so I guess my question to you is, and again, I actually just want to paint the picture to everyone who's listening here. Kasha has a system where sales agents jump on bikes and literally deliver these medical and healthcare services and products to individuals who have made the booking either online or through the telephone. And you've built this incredible network of delivery. But what about the absolute bottom of the bottom? People who cannot actually afford to buy the products. What is happening to them? And is there something that the government is doing? Because again, I feel like it's 20 years ago, you know, when I went to some of those regions in Rwanda, I was shocked about what I saw.
Yeah, Rwanda is a unique country, I mean, with a unique history as well. And it's important to remember that Rwanda less than 30 years ago went through an absolutely horrific genocide, which just decimated the health system, the education system, just everything. And so actually, I mean, the growth and the recovery that Rwanda has had is exceptional. That, you know, in terms of if you look at health statistics, and they have a very strong, very determined government in that space, and where there's no corruption. And so that's something that the health theirs is definitely, I mean, you definitely see improvement. And they're also very focused on private sector. And that's really important because a lot of other countries are very focused on donors and donor funding and getting that money. But, you know, just one of the reasons Kasha started in Rwanda and really, you know, we've become such a big business there is the government is very supportive of private sector and enabling it to grow. And especially when there's sustainable solutions that provide health and other services to all citizens. And that's a very powerful, sustainable thing, because I think one of the challenges is I don't think all the burden should be on government. You know, these governments are struggling. I mean, these are governments of low-income countries. And, you know, for example, Rwanda went through a genocide before that. I think this is a space, and for us to really change, enable access, we do need private sector and public sector working together. We also need donors, and we need NGOs. We need all players working together. And you're right, there's some populations who will never be able to pay. In that scenario, for example, you know, Kashai operates as a channel to deliver ARVs, HIV medication, and we don't charge for it. It is actually subsidized. It's a public health product. But we're providing a private sector service to ensure it gets to people who have HIV. And so I do think there's the aspect of this is actually also a private sector problem. It's not just a government problem, and we need to work together through it.
And how does Kasha work with the government?
We've worked in Rwanda specifically, just as an example, we've worked very closely with government from the beginning. When we first started, there was no online pharmacy license, for example. We were the first ones to basically do e-commerce of health products within Rwanda. And we worked closely with the government saying, this is how we align with your health policies. And we were able to operate. In fact, they used our operations as a template to enable others to do online pharmacies as well. And for years, we've been delivering also ARVs for them within their HIV space. We've done a lot of work, especially within the family planning and contraceptive space. One example, when they first introduced HIV self-tests into Rwanda, we were the only private sector partner selected. Everyone else was NGO. And we kept stocking out. We were their best delivery channel just because we could reach all 30 districts, the entire country. And so, you know, in that way, we've really been able to collaborate where we use our strength and technology and distribution and logistics and our agent network around the country who get paid. And, you know, it's a very sustainable model. And, you know, they focus on really understanding, you know, making sure that in that country, you know, they have the subsidized health products that the people who are especially poor can't afford, that they get them.
What I absolutely love about what you do is you also create jobs, right? So what we know, especially for women, is that it's not just about giving people access to the healthcare that they need. It's also about economic empowerment. And the fact that you have, you're taking a business approach to delivering necessary healthcare in all of these countries in Africa, but also you're strengthening the economy with what you're doing all around. The whole system is both providing healthcare and helping people to have jobs, which is what we know to be a sustainable solution to poverty. I have an interesting question. What about regulations in Africa? Talk us through that. Are you monitored at all? Expiry dates, things like that. You know, your logistics have got to be difficult, right? Especially if you're delivering things like ARVs. Talk to us about regulations. How are you monitored? And are they the same kind of regulations that we have here in the US?
Yeah. So there's definitely regulations that are in place. I would say in this continent, there's more gray space. So for example, in general, African governments still have a lot of work to do in adopting digital health solutions, health tech solutions, things like that. But many are advanced, you know, have licenses now. I think for any business, it is scary to operate in a gray space because you never know at some point if, you know, you could be breaking a rule. So regulations are a good thing. They show you the boundaries, and you work together to make sure, you know, you do the right thing. And so when we started, there was no online pharmacy license, you know, and also in Kenya, there was no online pharmacy license. And so it developed through the course of us running the business as well. You know, now there's also a Rwanda Food and Drug Administration. They definitely, you know, do checks and audits. We have the correct licenses and certifications that we need, whether that's wholesale pharmaceutical sales or retail. So the traditional kind of type of business, like wholesale and retail pharmacy, is there. It's really more in the digital space that more and more is evolving. And what is exciting here, though, is I would say every government that we've connected with recognizes that the majority of their population can greatly benefit from digital solutions because they're, you know, there's around the country and it's very, very hard to reach. And so there is more of an embracing, I would say, of digital solutions, but it's really around putting the, you know, the policies and the licenses in place. But yeah, I think it's just about working closely with government to make sure you do it together. Sometimes you can see global, especially American-based corporations that are very aggressively, and they actually purposely break all the rules because they want to aggressively grow. And I don't think that's the right way to do it. It's really to do it with government together and to grow a healthy and strong business.
Now, let's talk about the barriers for a second, because we know Rwanda is quite conservative, right? And again, I will reiterate, the government has done an incredible job, especially around HIV/AIDS. And as you said, picking up the country after the horrendous situation after the genocide and completely rebuilt Rwanda after that. And they should be commended for that. However, still quite a conservative country, and you do work in sexual reproductive health, which involves sex. I've experienced this my entire career everywhere. I'm not calling out Rwanda specifically. When you are working in a conservative country, just things like, you know, condoms and pills and, you know, sexual reproductive health, which does involve sex, can create some issues. So how do you do that? And you have done it very successfully. How do you overcome those barriers? Also around education, right? Because it's important that you educate your customers on why they need these products, right? Like condoms, which you do sell.
Yeah, for us, and this really goes back to the breadth of what we sell and our brand and how we position. And we're really around health from, you know, your hair to your toes. And we sell a variety of products around that. And so we don't, you know, come out and say, here's these, you know, let's talk about contraceptives, because that's difficult conversation to have up front. What we found is first starting with, you know, just general products that people need day to day and driving awareness around that. And then, you know, talking about things like menstrual care, and then talking about things like for pregnancy, and then talking about contraception. And so it's about building a relationship with customers and, you know, just providing awareness on the variety of products we sell. And, you know, by then people have built trust, and so they're able to ask questions. And that's what we see, is people buy other products before they'll buy the more stigmatized products. But in general, I find that in Africa, it's sometimes even not as much of a stigma around contraception as it is in somewhere like America. In America, it's sometimes even more a big deal, and there's more uprising in a sense, whereas, you know, because of the HIV/AIDS epidemic and various things, condoms are much more common, and all the healthcare campaigns and everything. So they're still stigmatized, but at least it's not as shocking to talk for the public campaigns to talk about it, whereas that may be there. But in the end, bring it back to health.
Well, talking about that and the gaps, right? Like, my life's mission is to fill the gaps that exist, especially in female healthcare. And one of those gaps is sexual wellness. And even if you take a medical approach to this, right? So vaginismus, for instance, and I do talk about this incessantly, because 50 million women are unable to have sexual intercourse because they have vaginismus. So literally the penis cannot enter the vagina through various reasons. Could be menopause, could be cancer. You know, when you've had cancer, you go into early menopause and suffer dryness, or it could be cultural reasons, you know, religion, being put into an arranged marriage. Like, there's so many reasons for it. And it's something that just isn't talked about, right? It's embarrassing for the woman. It's frustrating for the couple that can't consummate their relationship. You can't get pregnant, right? Because you can't actually have intercourse. And it's a real thing. It's a real thing that needs to be addressed. And, you know, you and I have talked about this a lot, that it does need a medical device, right? If you have vaginismus, there are solutions for it, but it needs to be communicated. And it's not communicated because of the stigma that is attached to it. even though this is a medical issue. And one thing that I have seen all over the world is that when something involves sex, it is not talked about. And there are reasons for that. You know, the individual, the woman feels embarrassed, right? That her body is not working in the way that it should be working. And, you know, there's a whole host of problems. Where does she go, right? What does she do? Does she go to her pharmacy? Does she go to her doctor? Like, you know, what does she do? If she even has the courage to be able to go there and seek help. So it is a massive gap and healthcare that really needs to be addressed. And I'm excited about our conversations about, you know, finding some of those solutions and doing it in a way that is culturally acceptable and relevant and is going to work.
Absolutely. And there's so many things, unfortunately, that go on the burden of women. Even if a couple can't get pregnant, you know, it's usually it's the woman. Let's do infertility. You know, so there's really a lot of stress women go through and a lot of secrets that are untalked about. And even more in a very close community. So I think just opening up these conversations and showing options and showing it's natural and normalizing things, but at the same time, understanding that the world is how the world is, right? We're not going to normalize everything overnight. So let's speak in confidential ways. Let's speak in terms that make people feel comfortable, but make sure they get the information they need and access to the products they need so that they live happy lives.
Well, Joanna, very sadly, we've come to the end of our podcast. Didn't that go quick? As always, chatting with you, I get so excited about the potential. It is remarkable what you have managed to do. And I would encourage everyone to go and look at Kasha and see the incredible work that Joanna and her team are doing around the world. Joanna, I'm also really excited about the conversations that we're having to change the world for girls and women. So thank you for being on the show, and can't wait to see you in person again when we come out next.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of Sex, Body, and Soul. Remember, you can find all my favorite products and resources to support your health and sexual wellness through my one-stop shop, The Body Agency. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast listening platform. We are actually partnering up with Vital Voices to get much-needed dignity kits to the refugees in Ukraine. Girls and women do not have access to personal hygiene products that keep them safe and healthy. Please go to thebodyagency.com to donate a dignity kit today. Be sure also to sign up for our email list at The Body Agency for the latest curated recommendations from our industry experts, and use our special promotional code PODCAST10 to get a 10% discount. Thank you for listening.